Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another great episode of Mentoring Developers. I'm really excited about this interview with one of my favorite people, the nicest guy in technology, Daryl Miller. Daryl is a very, very experienced API developer, and he's been building distributed business applications, mainly on the Microsoft platform, for over 20 years. Currently, he works for Microsoft as an API evangelist. So his job is to talk about APIs, RESTful services, how to build good clients for those API services, as well as what makes a good API. In his talks at conferences, he's also a very active member of the .NET community. He has open source contributions. And he is a great person for new developers and experienced developers to listen to, because he's going to talk about technologies, he's going to talk about his work, but he's also going to talk about his work ethic, and he's going to talk about his experiences as he started in this field. So we can take inspiration from his achievements and hopefully aspire to be more like him. Well, certainly it's hard to be as nice as him, but we can try. So, without further delay, here's my interview, part one, with Daryl Miller. Hi, Daryl. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. It's so exciting to have you. I have followed you for a number of years. I know that you are a very prominent speaker. You're an author, and you're an all-around nice guy, and I met you at a conference, and that's how we got introduced. So I know a lot about you, but I don't know if all of our audience knows about you. So tell us about yourself. Tell us how you got started. How do you see yourself? How do you describe yourself?
That's a big question. I think, you know, from a professional perspective, I see myself as a software developer. I love writing software. I have for many, many years. I love the creative aspect of it. I love the fact that I can do something and then make a mistake and just go back and fix it at any point in time. I think that's really, I have no fear in creating things in software because I can always go back and fix it. I've been in the industry doing it for just over 20 years now. A large part of my career was spent building line of business applications, payroll, time and attendance, inventory management. In fact, I had my own company, myself and my wife, for many, many years, selling a large software product to small manufacturing companies. And I got involved in every aspect of the software business, from, you know, making the cold calls to the companies to try and get to go and do the demo, and sitting there and demoing the product and fielding all the objections and doing the research into competitive products, and even then to the point of actually doing the installation. And, you know, they're small companies, so I'd end up doing IT support and recommending what servers to buy and deploying and installing servers, and like just end to end. But it always came down to, I love being able to build tools that you could deliver to end users and help them do their job, make their lives easier with that software, and make them more effective. That was just really the reward I was always looking for in building software.
So that was your company that you had for a number of years. You're building products, but you gave that up, and now you're working for a big technology giant, I've heard.
Well, it's been about 2 years now that I haven't really, well, actually a little bit longer than that. I did some consulting work for Ward Bell's company, IdeaBlade, working on one of their WPF line of business applications. And then just over a year ago, I started working for Runscope in a completely different position. I was working as an evangelist, effectively a developer advocate. And I guess it's a bit of an interesting story how that transition happened. Is as I was building my own product, probably 10 years ago now, I started to learn about new ways to build distributed systems, and I got into the whole REST and HTTP type thing, learning that infrastructure and learning that architecture. And I started getting interested in going to conferences and stuff and learning more, and I got involved with the community, and I learned more and more about those things. And then all of a sudden that turned into, well, going to local meetups and speaking about the things that I'd learned. And then I started writing open source stuff and got involved in that community. And that kind of led me informally into this developer advocate role. So when John Sheehan asked if I was interested in coming doing it on behalf of RunScope, I jumped at the opportunity. Just this year, just recently, I started as an API evangelist at Microsoft, evangelizing their API products and helping developers to build APIs on the Azure infrastructure, either using ASP.NET, web API, or using API management, using their API apps, all of that type of infrastructure. That's where I'm focused on at the moment.
So there's a lot of buzzwords here, which I think is very exciting, but it could be confusing for a new developer or somebody who's just starting out. You talked about Azure or Windows Azure, like we'd like to call it, or Microsoft Azure now. And that's their cloud infrastructure, which is, again, a thing that people may not be familiar with, but it's what is it?
That's a very good question. Cloud services, right? Basically, we don't need to manage our own servers anymore. We can get somebody else to manage our servers for us. And there's all different flavors of cloud service. There's what they call infrastructure as a service, so instead of taking my server and go and co-locating it at a ISP, I just say, well, could you provision a server for me? And chances are it's just going to be a virtual server. So then I can SSH or remote desktop into that remote machine. So that's one type of cloud service. And then we have this other whole layer, which is the platform as a service, where there's value-added infrastructure in the cloud so we can build apps and just kind of deploy them up to infrastructure that already exists in the cloud. And we don't have direct access to the PCs and servers. We're deploying our applications on top of that infrastructure, all of which is just, it's a way of making it faster for us to and spend more time focusing on actually building a product and less time worrying about managing the infrastructure that's out there, the infrastructure that our systems are running on. Because as I say, when I was back selling ERP software to small businesses, you'd walk in there and it's like, okay, so where's your server? And they go, oh, we don't have a server. We just have some Windows for Workgroups type network. So then you'd have to explain to them why they need to spend money on this extra machine in order to be able to deploy the SQL Server and the other infrastructure there. And that's just, you don't need to do that anymore because you can just deploy these virtual machines or these applications directly onto cloud services. So as you say, Microsoft's Azure is the cloud service offering by Microsoft. Amazon have AWS, and there's a whole bunch of other different cloud providers all kind of doing the same thing. But it's good because technology just grows constantly, and there's no way we can keep up with understanding all of this stuff. So being able to offload some of that responsibility onto some other, turnkey type service lets us again focus on writing business apps or whatever, productivity apps, consumer apps that'll actually allow the end user to do what they want to do.
Yeah, one of the difficulties of explaining a buzzword or a technical term is that inevitably you end up using more buzzwords and more technology terms. So it's a Pandora's box, but it's a real problem. I think that if I want to talk about why you need a cloud-based service, I will say perhaps that you need to run your program in a computer And if it's a website, then it needs to be accessible. So it needs to be like a server type of computer, and you can certainly run it in your own home if you're able to, if your ISP allows, right? You need a server somewhere. But if you don't want to deal with it, that's not your problem. That is not your core competency. And you just want a website that pulls data from a database and shows it to a user, perhaps, then it doesn't, you don't care where it is stored. So then you can, you have two choices. You can go to a hosting service, or you can take control of that, a whole computer in a cloud, like Windows Azure or Microsoft Azure or AWS can give you a computer that you can run whatever you want on. Or there's these other services where you can take your code, take your program and deploy it to an environment, and the environment is entirely managed by, for example, a platform as a service.
Right.
So that's another possibility. So there's several opportunities. Obviously, we're not going to learn about all of them in this podcast, but it's an exciting time for us, for software developers, where we, in the cases where we're not really interested in maintaining our infrastructure, we don't really care where it's stored, how it's served. That's all details that we don't care about. We just care about the fact that we can log into a website, we can get our data, and we can save it, and we can retrieve it, and then we can share it with the world. If that's what you want, which is, I'd say, 90% of web development is about that, and then you're in good shape, and you can do it very cheaply. Right? That's another benefit.
It's ironic in that, in an effort to try and make life easier for people, we've also made it more complicated at the same time, because now there's a whole host of different options of ways of doing it. It used to be, well, we just go and we go to Dell and we buy, select a server, and we get it delivered and we plug it in, and there we have our server. And now we have to choose, well, what platform should I use? Infrastructure as a service? Should I use platform as a service? Which platform as a service am I going to use? We've just replaced one set of choices with another set of choices, unfortunately.
Yeah, things are just getting complicated, more and more complicated, because back in the day, you went before the time of the web, you know, it was very simple. You had complete control before multitasking operating systems. You know, things were easier, but now we have to, if you want to build a program, a piece of software that runs within the computer, you don't really care about the web, you still have to worry about different platforms, whether you're going to do it in Windows or a Mac, or maybe you want to build an app for a mobile device, and then which mobile device, and if it's Android or iOS or Windows, or if it's Windows, which version? If it's Android, which version of that? And if it's if it's iOS, then is it for iPhone or iPod or iPad? And which version of iPod? And it is very difficult to figure out what to do, because we have evolved to a point where things are complicated. And I think that naturally this happens to all fields of science and all fields of technology over time, and what we need to do is focus. We can't just be a programmer anymore. We can't just be even a web developer anymore or an app developer anymore. I think it's time that, my personal opinion is that it's time we focused. You're focusing these days on, my impression is that you're focusing strictly on REST services development, which is, again, another buzzword, right?
But, well, let's take it even one step lower than that. Let's talk about HTTP services. And I think it ties in well with our conversation of, well, how do we deal with all this complexity? And yes, things are changing all the time. But if you also look at computer science from a different perspective, is some things haven't changed in a very long time also. And I think that's how you can survive in this industry, is you have to get back down to some of the fundamentals and basics and look at the stuff that really hasn't changed in a long time. One of the reasons I really started investing my time learning about HTTP was back in 2006, 2007. And I was like, well, here's a protocol that hasn't changed at all in the last 8 years. And we're now 8 years later, and it really still hasn't changed anything. They just clarified the documentation. Even if you look at the latest HTTP 2, it doesn't change the way that you build applications. The semantics of it are identical. And that's the, I think that's what you have to do as and it is a trap that new developers fall into. They see this complexity and they see tooling and frameworks that say, look, just come use our tooling and we'll solve all your problems from end to end. We'll give you from full stack, from front to back. And you just use our tool, learn our tool, and you'll be able to do everything because it's protecting them from that complexity. But as an old guy, like that's the trap I fell into many, many years ago, 1996, using FoxPro for DOS, where it had a back-end database, had a front-end GUI, it had dynamic language, you could build everything all in an integrated environment, the edit, debug, compile cycle was really, really fast, and I could whip things up very, very quickly. But things change, and that becomes out of date. The fundamentals underneath it don't change, but frameworks and approaches do change. And that's one way that I survive, is I don't spend very much of my time learning all the newest, latest, and greatest frameworks, because I know the shiny stuff on the surface is going to be replaced with new shiny stuff in a relatively short amount of time. And some of that has large surface area, especially when you're trying to build a full stack and people keep trying to build all these new things, and it takes a lot of time to learn, and I know that it's going to go away in a very short space. You know, learning things like SQL, even that NoSQL exists now, and NoSQL is a very interesting... Okay, so I'm doing it again. I'm bringing in terminology, but for the longest time, 30 years, the primary way of storing data has been with relational databases, and we use SQL queries in order to access that. Over the last 5 to 10 years, we've had this movement of NoSQL, which is an alternative to SQL, but now what you're starting to see is they're kind of blending together, and there are always advantages to new techniques, but you have to be able to look, cut through, and see what the fundamental differences are and not get distracted by these frameworks that promise they're going to make your life really, really easy, because chances are they're not going to make your life easy. Software has been hard and still is hard and will continue to be hard to do really well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that with experience, you learn that certain lessons that will benefit you, especially that take it easy, do not get overwhelmed, and do not get flustered, because all of us have gone through this. I want you to talk about your early experiences, how you got started with programming. How did you struggle with anything? How was your experience getting started?
Well, I played video games back in the arcade day game years in the very early 80s, and my parents decided that it was probably going to cost them a fortune or cost me a fortune, so I got a computer in 1982. It was my first machine. I was 12 years old at the time, and I remember I'd watched some TV show. I didn't know anything about what a computer was, and I'd seen some TV show where a kid basically walked up to the computer and he had homework to do, and he asked the computer to tell him the answers to his homework, and the computer just, spit out the answers. He knew everything, and I was like, wow, this is awesome. And I remember the computer arriving like the first day, and I kind of turned it on and looked at it and talked to my parents, and I was like, well, okay, so what can I get it to do? And they're like, well, it doesn't really do anything unless you tell it to do it. And I kind of looked at them funnily and, okay, well, what can I tell it to do? And they're like, well, you could get it to add two numbers together. So that was my first basic program, was I assigned two variables with a number, and then I added the two variables up and I printed the number out. And on the one hand, I was really kind of disappointed. And on the other hand, there was just kind of this spark there of, oh, I can get it to do whatever I want. And for the next few years, I spent an inordinate amount of time playing, writing BASIC. I was back in England at the time, so it was a BBC microcomputer with 32K of RAM. And one of the really nice things that you could do is you could actually do... It was a really quite a good BASIC language, not like the MS-DOS BASIC thing. And you could do inline assembler, so I taught myself 6502 assembler, and I wrote myself a disassembler, and I did all kinds of things with that machine. So that really sparked my interest in writing software. And then at 16, I moved over to Canada, and I kind of left my BBC at home, and I went out and bought an IBM PC, and I was deeply disappointed with the BASIC, and I tried GW BASIC and was fairly disappointed. So then the one big difference between North America and England was local calls were free in North America. So I learned what a modem was, and I got involved with bulletin boards and downloading software. And I spent the next few years basically playing with software and using software and playing games and not really doing much writing. I didn't start writing software again until probably just before university, when I got Turbo Pascal version 5.5 from Borland. And that was the first version that they introduced object-oriented programming. So I taught myself object-oriented programming from that. And that's when I started to write software again, when I started going through university.
I remember using Turbo Pascal. That Borland IDE was amazing.
It was quite fabulous. But back in those days, if you wanted a C compiler, a C++ compiler, you were talking hundreds and hundreds of dollars. The Microsoft one was ridiculously expensive. The Borland one wasn't so bad. But I remember I did some C++ back in those days. They had the same environment. But then again, this is all back in the DOS days. And I went through computer engineering because at university I'd sort of, you know, I knew software was my thing. I was like, well, maybe hardware is something that interests me too. And I really hated all the hardware courses that I took through university. And the software courses were fairly terrible. I remember there was one course, a data structures course, that I think I actually got some value out of. But other than that, although I did see Ada and Modula 2, I believe it was, which I thought were really quite kind of cool languages. And I did a little bit of Lisp in university, which was also quite a cool language. I think if I were to go through the process again, I would definitely make sure as a young developer I learn as many languages as possible before you get really used to any one language. Because I think once you get used to one or two languages, it's really quite difficult to move to another language, especially if you're actually trying to be productive and trying to do stuff. Learning as many languages as you can whilst you're young is a good idea, because it seems to get harder as you get older. Or maybe that's just me.
I think that once you're entrenched into an ecosystem, when you've learned the tools, when you've learned, if you're using an IDE, you know all the shortcuts, it's just hard to give up that productivity. So I think that's maybe where you're coming from. But I wanted to ask you about the choice of programming languages, because there are a ton of programming languages. And I think you're correct that we should, as new developers, we should try to learn as many languages as possible, at least get acquainted with it. But I think that there are some distinctions here. So there are categories of programming languages. There are object-oriented languages. There are functional languages. There are procedural languages. There are different kinds of languages. Does it matter what kind of language you learn, or just learn as much as you can? Don't worry about what type of language it is.
I think there's different classes of languages that are good for different types of problems. And I think it's good to get experiences with the different types of languages. I mean, you learn a systems programming language. Now you could go and learn C, but now there's Rust, right? So Rust, if I was looking into learning a systems programming language, I probably wouldn't go and look at C. I'd probably go and look at Rust. If I'm looking for something that's more dynamic, you could go to the Ruby route, you could go the Python route. Pick one. I wouldn't necessarily say, well, you have to learn both. But then that could be just my personal preference, because I've never really been able to grok Ruby. Python I don't mind too much, but Ruby is just one of those things that rubs me the wrong way. I don't know, but again, it's strange. And like things like XSLT, I think is fabulous. I love using XSLT, and many people just can't stand it. So there's definitely a personal preference that goes into that. I love SQL. Writing SQL queries. I mean, I've written so many SQL queries over my career, and I think it's fabulous because it's the declarative nature of both XSLT and SQL. It's really nice. You don't have to worry about going and mentally traversing through loops and worrying about state. It's like you're just making a statement about this is what I want the output to be when this is what the input is. So there's a really nice simplicity to that. I'd love to get the opportunity to spend more time working with something like F#, because I think that's a nice blend. It's a functional language that fits well into the ecosystem that I already know. And I've played around with tutorials a bit, but you need to really have a project that you need to deliver, or I do. I need to have something that I really need to deliver to force me to work on something regularly for it to stick. If I just tinker with tutorials and walk through tutorial, I can walk through the tutorial and by the end of it, I've kind of forgotten it. I had the opportunity at Runscope to do a little bit of work in Go, and Go felt very natural for me. And I was able to write some stuff in it, and that I like that. The one nice thing about Go is the environment that you work in is really nice. It's just really easy to get set up. It's easy to take on dependencies. It's easy to compile and test. It's not so easy to debug, but just because the tooling isn't there yet. But it's a great example of having a fairly constrained or at least having a recommended configuration set up so that everything just works. So that was a really good experience for me. But I mean, my early years of experience were with more kind of database tools, because my objective was to build database type applications. So I started with the FoxPro for DOS, and I moved to FoxPro for Visual FoxPro, which was Microsoft's first object-oriented language. And then I moved on to Visual Basic 6, going against SQL Server as a backend, and then slowly transition between Visual Basic 6 and C#. And C# has been my main staple for the last 10 years. Although I still do support applications running in VB6. I have
my commiserations.
Production application. You know what? I really don't mind going back into that code.
Wow.
Because the thing about VB6 is, it did some, one of the things, it was way better than Visual FoxPro in that Visual FoxPro allowed inheritance and was dynamic. And you could get yourself into a complete mess, because you could go into some base class somewhere and make a change, and you wouldn't find out for weeks in production that you had actually really screwed something up somewhere else completely different in the application. Because going back to when I was working on that, the idea of unit testing frameworks, just they weren't there, right? We just didn't, very few people built extensive amounts of unit tests. And with the dynamic language, I think it's a critical thing that you have really good unit tests, testing your stuff to allow you to change. So when I moved into VB, we had no inheritance. We only had interfaces. But interfaces solved the vast majority of the problems that I needed, and it you can build, you can follow a lot of the same principles, you know, that we're doing, you know, the whole MVC, MVP, model view presenter type patterns. I was doing that stuff in VB6 because it just kind of evolved naturally out of the type of decoupling that I needed to do to make the user interfaces that I was building manageable over time. So you know, people, there was a lot of horrific code written in VB6 with UI controls. Actually, probably UI control vendors were probably the source of a lot of the thing. Again, it comes back to, oh, we have this wonderful tool. Just install this tool, and it will do everything for you, and it'll make it really easy. But maintaining that stuff was a nightmare. But you can write fairly clean Visual Basic code, and I know that I can go back into, it's an application with probably 600,000-700,000 lines of VB6 code, and I can fairly comfortably go into that and make changes, add new fields to screens, add new elements to the database, and I wouldn't have a big concern doing that.
Let us know how we are doing by tweeting at us at MentoringDevs. And if you are enjoying the show, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Now, let's get back to the show.
That's great. I think that one of the reasons is that you're the original author, so
yeah, that does help.
You have the layout in your head, and also, I mean, you're using the MVP pattern. You can have these patterns in any language, but the language doesn't support it, so you have to write a lot of boilerplate. And so if everybody agreed on a pattern, and so we're going to do this type of development in VB6 or C++ or whatever, if everybody agreed on that, and I could go into a code base and I would know where things should be, how they should be laid out, and I can spot a mistake because it sort of stands out if it's a little bit off.
Yeah.
But the problem with this, with these types of languages, which don't really go on with convention, frameworks rather, like Ruby on Rails or ASP.NET MVC or other frameworks like that, they want you to follow a convention so that you don't have to write a lot of boilerplate, which I think is the point of this. You can certainly do everything in VB6 or any other language. So, I don't know if you agree with me on that.
Yeah, you can do... People ascribe to languages far more power than I think they necessarily have. I think you can do a lot of things. It has far more to do with your organizational structure of how you build the program than it does with regards to the features of the language. Okay, some languages enable certain features that make it easier to do things in a more modular and more organized way. But I think the elephant's share of what goes into making good software is about how you structure it and how you plan it and how you build it, not necessarily features of a particular language. At least I don't think so.
I want to ask you about your education. I get a feeling that you were really good at math in high school or college or something that you enjoyed. Is that a correct feeling?
I was fairly good at math towards the end of my high school period. I was never particularly, I mean, I was an above average student from an academic point of view, but I was never the top student. And you know, I have a reasonable comprehension of applied math, but my theoretical math is very, very non-existent. So, I think a lot of what I've achieved in the software development space is through painful experience and keeping trying and trying to follow good practices and principles and continually learning and continually looking at how other people are doing things and reading and learning from others. There's no, The only innate natural talent I think I have, and it usually can bite me in the butt, is I tend to have the ability to look at two completely different concepts and find a way of merging them together in ways that other people tend not to see very often. So I have a bit of a vision insofar as being able to combine things that you wouldn't think would go together. And that has been handy at times. It's also taken me down some rather strange paths at times also. But no, as far as ability, it's a case of it's sweat and long hours, really, I think, more than anything.
So anybody can do it? Do you think anybody...
No, you need to love it to do it well. Anybody can do it, right? I mean, software, it's a mechanical process. If you've got the aptitude for that kind of thing, most people could learn to write software. I think if you want to be really good at writing software, you have to love doing it and you have to spend the time to learn, because there is so much to learn about doing it well.
And I would say that you would probably need to specialize in something. You have to pick your battles.
It's a mix there, insofar as I think you need... It's good to specialize in certain areas, but it's also very good to have general knowledge of other areas. You can't complete... Well, you could, but I don't think it's the healthiest approach to completely focus on one area. If you want to be effective at participating in teams and building products, because when you develop a software product, generally there are many aspects to it. There's the storage aspect, there's the user interface aspect, there's the business logic, there's humans actually interacting with it. So there are many aspects to it, and I think it's good to have a solid understanding of all of those aspects. Maybe not a really, really in-depth. Like, I would never consider myself a particularly talented UI person, UI designer, but I understand a reasonable amount about the concepts, and I have a fairly good idea of being able to say, okay, this is an effective UI, and this one isn't an effective UI. But I'm not a particularly creative person when it comes to UIs.
Which is a case with most of the people that I work with. I think UI, making good user interfaces, is just such a unique skill. It's just incredible. I have so much respect for people who can do that.
Yeah, and it goes to the other end too. It's like databases, right? I think I know more than a lot of developers about actually how databases work behind the scenes, because I've had to deal with tuning really ridiculous queries and dealing with indexes. And I think there's a lack of knowledge in a lot of developers there who are focused more on the middle tier and building the web stuff. I think you need to have a reasonable understanding of how databases work and how they perform to do your job in the middleware well. I don't think you can be completely ignorant of it.
Fair point. But I wonder where they would go to get that knowledge, because I think you said earlier that when you learn something, you have to, it has to be in a context of a project. So you're in a project and something needs to get done. You roll your sleeves and you get in there and you do what needs to be done. New programming language. Maybe there's a query that's taken a long time. You need to tune it. But until you have that problem, do you go out and seek that? How does a new guy go in and become really good at databases?
That's an interesting, obviously being involved in a project is really helpful when it comes to that. I think the comment I made earlier about I need to work on a project to learn it, for me, was aimed specifically at learning languages. There's something that feels a little bit different about learning a language. I'm not sure what it is. I feel that I can read papers or document or blog posts or articles on other topics and get a feel for those topics and retain that information better than I can with languages as such. Again, even with languages, I think you can go and read about a topic and get an idea of, this particular topic is useful when you have this type of problem. Okay, fine. File that away. When I have that type of problem, go back and find out more about that particular information. And I think that's what's useful is like, oh, I have an XML document that I need to reshape into some different format. You know what? XSLT is really good at doing that, right? I need to do a query against a whole bunch of data tables to be able to merge all this data together. I know SQL is good at doing that. And you may not know how to do it. You may not have sufficient knowledge, but at least you know where to go looking. I think the other thing about learning, and I mean, it's so, developers possibly don't realize how amazing it is today insofar as how easy it is to get information as compared to what it was like pre-internet days. If you want to learn about a particular topic, you can just go out and find information about that particular topic. The danger of the internet is there's lots of wrong information on the internet. So how do you know what is the right information? And I mean, for me, it's always been about the people. And that's one of the things that I think Twitter has been the most valuable for. It's allowed me, and I suppose blogs before that also were another valuable way of finding people who have expertise in a specific domain. And I think you follow the people who you know are experts in that area. And just to an extent by osmosis, by reading the blog post that they write, even if you don't understand it, you'll slowly start to gain their perspective on that particular topic. And if you follow the people that you respect or you believe or understand to be experts in that field, then you will start to get a good understanding of it. And for me, that's the way I filter information from this vast body of flotsam and jetsam that is the internet. Is you follow the people and the information will come after that.
I'm thinking about your career. Admittedly, I don't know everything there is to know about it. I know that you've written books, and for the last several years, I've heard you talk about HTTP-based services, REST services, whether creating them or consuming them. It's a very specialized topic, and it's really modern in a way that it allows different types of clients, perhaps mobile clients, perhaps web browsers of all kinds, and anything else, to get information or to connect to some kind of business logic repository, something called a service, which then can perhaps even drive the user interface in a certain way or not. These are all very, really modern, I think, 21st century questions that we weren't thinking about, I think, earlier. And I also look at, you know, the work that you have done. Perhaps my information is outdated, so you can update me. But the product that you were building as when you had your own company was an ERP solution.
Yes.
for manufacturing, which is something that interests me personally because that's something very similar to what I'm trying to build. But I have a very, very small niche and small specific scenario in mind. But I was wondering, you were using REST, and based on the interviews that I've heard of you, you were using these same concepts in very traditional, very enterprisey, very, you know, unusual environments. So yes. I wanted to ask you about your motivation, because you're talking about these very advanced topics. But you're building very, you know, you're talking about Battleship Gray. You're building things that for your clients, they don't care. They really don't care how you do it. But you're doing it in modern ways.
Okay.
So what's your motive? Why are you doing that? And what's your motivation?
One word, change. You see, we have to constantly deal with change. And the problem of business systems, it used to be really, really easy when you could build a business system where all the data for that business application was stored on that one computer, and the person who was sitting in front of it was editing that whatever accounting application, whatever it was, they had the data and they were the only one looking at it. As soon as we got into networks, local area networks within businesses, where the data was not on the computer that the person was working on, it was on some shared file server, and now we had multiple users all accessing that same data, everything changes at that point. Because now you have contention, you have concurrency issues insofar as, well, am I looking at out-of-date information? I've got two users both trying to edit the same piece of information, and then we have to control that information. So now all of a sudden, we need to have some code on the server and some code on the client in order to orchestrate the ability for more than one person to work on a centralized piece of data. Now, it's specifically relevant in a business scenario and less so in a consumer scenario, because let's take consumer scenarios as I'm building a to-do list. Well, it's my to-do list and nobody else is going to look at my to-do list. I have a calendar application. I might be out in the cloud, but it's only me looking at it. In a business type scenario, you've got inventory information that maybe there are multiple order entry clerks that are consuming information from inventory. You've got people who are ordering material, and you may have multiple purchasing people. Well, you don't want them to be purchasing the same thing. You've got people releasing work out into the shop floor. There's all kinds of concurrency issues because all the people in that company are all trying to work on the same set of that same set of data and manipulate that same set of data. So over the years, we've tried a number of different ways of balancing where the logic should go. How much logic should we have on the server? How much logic should we have on the client? And we keep flipping backwards and forwards as to where we should put all the data. If we go back to the days of mainframe computers, all the logic used to be on the servers, and the only thing that got reflected down to the client was just kind of a green screen with some fields to enter. And then we moved into the PC era, and we moved all of the logic onto the clients, and the only thing on the server was a file server. We used ISAM databases that really was just a file, and we held locks open, and we just read the bytes over the wire, and then the clients did all of the work there. But we needed to have record locking so that you didn't have two people editing the same information. And then that had scalability issues. So then we introduced client-server databases where we moved a big chunk of the data processing back onto the server, but we kept the UI manipulation on the client. So then we were kind of in a hybrid situation. Then we moved to the web, and the web moved all of the work back onto the server, and the only thing, it was almost back to green screen mainframe days where we only had like HTML on the front end, and all the work is on the back end. So it keeps going backwards and forwards because we can't figure out what is the right balance. Because what happens is, as soon as you have code on both the client and on the server, they need to be in sync a little bit, right? And they need to be talking about the same data structures, and they need to be talking about the same pieces of information. And if you make a change, it's easy to make a change on the server side. You can make that very quick because that's only in one place. But now we have to also synchronize and make sure all the clients understand that that change has just been made. So maybe we need to do updates to all of the clients. And I'll go back to a very specific time in probably around about 2006. I was working on this ERP software, and we had punch clocks out on the shop floor that were using embedded XP-type operating systems, and we were using handheld scanners that had Windows CE, and we were communicating backwards and forwards using SOAP. to make requests backwards and forwards from these client devices to the server devices to the server, and we had logic on the server because that was where it made sense to make some of these business decisions close to where the data was. That was the most efficient place for it. So I had an update to do with the .NET framework, and I updated the .NET framework, and that triggered, oh, you also need to update the SOAP toolkit that you're using. And guess what? All of a sudden, that broke a bunch of my clients. Well, updating the XP embedded, I had to update the .NET framework or some library on it. If I needed to update that, I had to send the device back to the manufacturer to get it to be updated. And as far as that $2,700 handheld scanner, you can't update the OS, the Windows COS on that thing. So all of a sudden, it just kind of dawned on me as we have this amazing amount of coupling between the client and the server that is completely unnecessary, because all I was trying to do was add one new feature that I needed the new .NET framework for, and there was this massive cascading effect. And that's what led me to looking at HTTP and saying, look, this is a protocol for building distributed applications. It's worked really well for the web, and they haven't changed this protocol in a very long time. So how is it that we are able to build all the stuff on the web, and yet what seems like even the slightest change in my business system seems to have all these cascading effects around? And that's when I started to learn about REST. And REST was a description of the constraints that were used in defining HTTP in order to build systems that could evolve, where you have different components that exist in a distributed system, and those components need to be able to evolve independently. And if you follow a certain set of rules when you're building your software, like we were talking about before, it doesn't really matter what language you're using. As long as you have the right patterns and you use the right approaches, the software will be maintainable. Well, if you follow the same rules, and you follow these constraints, you'll build systems that can evolve and can change. And that is what pushed me towards completely redesigning our ERP system to use this much more flexible model so that I could change various components of our system independently without causing these cascading effects around. Because the one thing that the cascading effects do once you move into a business environment is they lock you down. All of a sudden, you can't update this component because you know it will affect this component, and for some reason, we can't change that component. I've run into it in other companies that I've worked for where the deployed software out to multiple different customers, it's been a multi-tenant type of scenario, and we've wanted to update the server component to provide some feature for one customer, but then another customer said, well, no, you can't do updates at the moment. We're busy doing our year end, so we don't want you to touch any of our client stuff. So because there was the coupling between the client and the server, we couldn't. So now all of a sudden we had to start managing multiple different versions simultaneously on the server and dealing with all the orchestration issues there. So managing change is huge in software. And I started out by saying one of the things I loved about software was the fact that you can change it and go back and fix things. So as soon as you start introducing things that stop me from changing software, I don't like doing it anymore. And that's really where the whole drive for learning how to build evolvable systems has come about.
So ladies and gentlemen, children and adults, teenagers, all you wonderful people, this concludes part one of my interview with the amazing Daryl Miller. He's the nicest guy in the world, and stay tuned for the conclusion of this interview in the next episode of Mentoring Developers. Also, don't forget to go to iTunes, give us a rating and a review. I'd really like to know how you're enjoying the show, and it'll help us spread the word. Thanks a lot, and I'll see you around later.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.